Joining us on the program, as she does every couple of weeks, London listeners, you're very familiar with Pam Colleen. She's a nutritional consultant. Hello, Pam.
Good morning, Tom. How are you today?
I am terrific. How are you?
I'm fantastic.
We always, every once in a while, we have these great food discussions on the air, and we always time it around noon hour just to get everyone's hunger going. So yesterday we had a big talk on pizza. But I want to talk to you because there was a couple, yesterday was the debut of a show. Now, I watched part of the first episode, and then I'm going to tape the rest to watch it. And it's HBO's four-part documentary, The Weight of the Nation, talking about, and we're, Canada is not skinny Canada. We're not as bad as the United States in terms of being overweight and obese, but we have an overweight problem, just like the United States, in terms of obesity. What's worse is childhood obesity, but what, you know, from a fiscal standpoint, it costs so much extra to treat obesity, but at the same time, undernutrition for, and you love to talk about undernutrition for the brain, costs us a huge amount as well. But let me first talk about, because I know I want to get to, there's a number of things I want to get to you with you in the media and food. But first of all, The Weight of the Nation, the first two parts last night, what did you think of it?
Well, I thought that essentially they were skirting a lot of the issues that have been surfacing, really showing the true cause of obesity. They were still harping on this notion that it's about calories in, calories out, that somehow or another exercise is going to solve the problem. You know, these are all red herrings. They really, we know that they don't work, but unfortunately the producers of this series, you know, focus on these issues and ignore the new science, which is showing that what we should be doing is returning to traditional fats, you know, returning to things like meat and butter, all of these nutrient-dense foods, because they're the foods that actually stabilize our hormones and help help control our weight. Now, something else in the media that took place, which I was really happy to see, was the front cover of Newsweek magazine and an article written by Gary Taubes, who wrote the book Good Calories, Bad Calories, and then wrote a second book called Why We Get Fat. And Gary is clearly very frustrated by this series as well, because again, he's saying, you know, they're just not looking at the new science. They're not looking at common sense. They keep blaming things like animal fats and touting the benefits of whole grains and fruits and vegetables when it's these very foods that actually are contributing to the problem.
Now, let me ask you, because up to a point though, calories in, calories out, calories in, calories out, up to a point, I mean, makes sense. I mean, if you restrict calories, I mean, eventually you lose weight. However, the rebound effect usually seems to be worse. That if we restrict calories for a certain amount of time, once you then stop restricting calories, the body does what it typically does. It eats more than ever. But I mean, calories in, calories out, there's a point to it. But I guess long term, it's not effective. And the other thing about exercise, though, doesn't exercise, there's not many fat Olympians. I'll say that, unless you're in a sport where fat doesn't matter. But when we look at, you know, isn't there, you know, exercise, doesn't it speed up our metabolism? I know that going for a run, and I think Taubes makes this point, you know, going for a 3-mile jog burns the equivalent of like a Snickers. I mean, it's really not worth it in terms of effort. But doesn't it speed up our metabolism overall? So, I mean, when we look at athletes who, I know they eat better than ever before, but they're in great shape. I mean, they're in great shape because they, you know, they don't have those sedentary moments that most of us have.
Yeah, but I can't tell you the number of people I meet who exercise in order to lose weight. That's their goal in terms of choosing to exercise. And they exercise beyond belief, and they gain weight. They don't lose weight. And the reason why is because for some individuals, of course, what it's doing is it's stressing the adrenal glands and increasing the stress hormone cortisol, which drives up insulin, which will store fat. So you have to look even deeper at the metabolism and what it can do. So when I'm working with people who have things like chronic fatigue, depression, you know, they believe they have thyroid problems, for example, and I have to get them to rest because I need those adrenal glands to underproduce and to stop producing too much cortisol, and that's one of the main problems with overexercise, and not just with the cortisol, but also with adrenaline. People can over-secrete adrenaline, and that can disrupt their nervous system as well. So there is a dark side to overexercise, and that's what's being ignored. And when I watch,
but not non-exercise though.
No, I'm a big fan of exercise. It's got to be the appropriate.
Right. Okay. Good. All right. Yeah. Because some people will be like, "Oh, wait a second. I can just sit on the couch." and this will be better for me. No, not, but you're saying, and this has been shown as well, and there's plenty of people, though, who maybe reward themselves, and Taubes talks about this, and I know this, who reward themselves after exercise with food. So it's just like everything you've burned, you've just put it all back in a couple of bites.
You've increased your appetite, so you're going to tend to eat, and that's going to negate any effects potentially of the exercise. So he doesn't see it in the long run as a really good solution to the problem. And actually, the research is showing this as well, and the HBO series is ignoring this research. So we can be thankful that at least Newsweek took the initiative to put a rebuttal to the HBO series on the front cover of their magazine. And the front cover shows a little baby sitting there with a serving of French fries in front of him. So it's showing that it's the carbohydrates that are the problem, and that's what we've been increasing over the last several decades, is we've been increasing our consumption of not just sugar, not just fruit drinks, not just sugary beverages, but we've been increasing our consumption of fruits and vegetables and grains. And I'm not saying that there's anything inherently wrong with eating fruits and vegetables. It's just we just don't want to eat too many of them because they displace more nutrient-dense calories like meat and butter potentially. So we have to be very discerning and be careful of the information that we're getting from Health Canada and from a lot of these healthy school initiatives, because essentially what they tend to promote is diets that are high in grains and fruits and vegetables and very low in animal fats.
What's interesting, and we'll take a break, but I'll leave it with this fact. In the last 100 years, our annual consumption of potatoes, thanks to French fries, has increased from 2 pounds per capita to 50 pounds per capita. Is there any reason why we have a fat problem when we're eating so many starchy foods like potatoes? There's right there. It's like, yeah, that's what a huge change in our diet. 10:17 is our time. Quick break in the program. Pam Colleen, nutritional consultant, joins us on the program. We'll be back to talk to Pam a little more after this on 1290 CJBK News Talk 610 CKTB. 10:23 is our time. This is News Talk 610 CKTB, News Talk 1290 CJBK. I'm a big fan of the television network HBO, but Pam Colleen and Gary Taubes, who wrote an article in Newsweek, have a problem with their latest documentary, The Weight of the Nation, because Pam, as much as, you know, people who do their own research and go to the textbooks and look it up and find out, you know, what's going on is great. And then talking about it in print or on the radio is another thing. The most powerful medium we have today is still television. So unfortunately, when you don't get it exactly right, or when you miss critical information or ignore what scientists are telling you, it again slows down or stops people from getting the right information. It'll take a few more years before it pounds through, because Taubes tells this great story about this woman, Hilda Brook, who had the first fat clinic, childhood obesity clinic, in 1934. Mm-hmm. And how she was startled by the number of fat kids she saw. Really fat kids, not only in clinics, but on the streets and subways and at schools. Imagine if she saw kids today.
Yes.
She would be shocked.
She saw these kids with obesity during the Depression when there wasn't a lot of food. So what these kids were doing is they were eating very cheap food and a lot of carbohydrate or plant-based foods. And so that's really what Gary Taubes is saying in the article, is that it was blatantly obvious that these kids were just simply not getting the right kinds of foods to support their metabolism, because the right kinds of food during the Depression would have been very hard to come by, things like meat and butter.
That's right.
They would have been more expensive foods. And so they weren't eating enough of those foods. This threw off their blood sugar metabolism, and that led to the obesity. So it wasn't that these kids were overeating whatsoever, Tom. And that's one of the greatest myths. So it's not about calories in, calories out. Gary Taubes also writes about the examples in Africa, for example, where you have these women who are morbidly obese, and they have no money, they have no real quality foods, but they're morbidly obese, and they come to these clinics with their children because their children are starving, and it just makes no sense that these women would be overeating when their children are starving. So it's another example that are in this calories in, calories out theory. So we need to look deeper to what's going on, and what we've seen happen over the last 50 years in particular is that we have been increasing our consumption of plant-based foods. And as we've been increasing our consumption of plant-based foods, this is throwing off our metabolism and increasing the risk of developing things like obesity and other health problems.
Now, when you talk about plant-based foods, people sometimes get that as saying, oh, wait a second, I shouldn't eat that salad. Not necessarily. It's more of the starches, the grains, the sugars, the simple refined carbohydrates that our body uses. And Taubes talks about this, mm-hmm. where it's the, and you talk about it a lot, and clearly there's a link to the modern epidemic of diabetes today, mm-hmm. and how it's being driven by insulin into our fat cells. And he points out in the article, it's in the medical textbooks. Like, this is how fat cells get fat. Insulin is the gatekeeper. This is the way it works. Not through fat, not through protein, not through other things we take in. It's through sugars. It's through mm-hmm. processed starches and starchy foods like potatoes and wheat. And that's how it happens.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I have a medical text from 1944, before the rise of the high-carbohydrate diet. And in this medical text, it shows very clearly that doctors used to recommend a diet of about 70% animal fat, 20% protein, and 10% carbohydrates. Now, remember, carbohydrates also include fruits and vegetables. And yes, I think that eating some fruits and vegetables, like you mentioned, Tom, is fine. But you see, some people actually eat way too many fruits and vegetables. So you have to be, there's still a level where you have to be very careful. I took it literally, when I was a vegetarian, I ate tons and tons of fruits and vegetables.
Right.
And eating too many fruits and vegetables can also dysregulate your blood sugar metabolism. And that can actually be something as seemingly benign as carrots or tomatoes or what have you. They're still sources of sugar, so you still don't want to overeat them. They are wonderful sources of antioxidants, and I think that's very important because the antioxidants are crucial for helping to preserve those wonderful animal fats that we should be eating.
Now, quickly, before, and we'll come back and talk about this, would that be where we apply something like a glycemic index?
Well, you still have to be careful with the glycemic index. I don't know if we have more time, then I can talk about it after the break.
Yeah, but for sure. Let's talk about it after the break, and okay. Then we'll get into the school nutrition program. And I want to talk to you. You sent me this article about a starvation diet, which is not as starvation as you think, but it's what they fed them that led to the starvation, especially the brain. Mm-hmm. That's where we saw the changes, because for a lot of people, I think the calories was 1,800, wasn't it?
Somewhere thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah, where it's
in
like
today's standards, that would seem to be a lot.
That would seem to be, well, a little less than what's recommended, but not 800 calories. It's 1,800 calories, but we'll talk about that, and I want to get your opinion on, so we'll do glycemic index, the starvation diet, and then the school nutrition program. The breakfast makes sense to me, but they could be better breakfasts probably to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll talk about those when we come back. Pam Killeen, nutritional consultant, joining us on the program. News is next on 1290 CJBK, News Talk 610 CKTB. Pam Killeen, nutritional consultant, joining us. Pam, I got a question from Steve in Hamilton. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Tom and Pam. How are you?
Great.
I'm great, Steve.
Good, good. Okay, Pam, I missed the beginning of your show. Are you saying that we need more animal products in our diet?
Yes. Essentially, that's exactly what I'm saying. What we've done over the last, say, 50 years is we've displaced the animal foods and replaced them with more plant-based foods. And the results, we look around us and we see what's happening in terms of obesity, mood disorders, the decline in our overall health. We evolved as humans, we evolved on animal foods. Our brains developed because of some very, nutrient-dense foods that helped facilitate the growth of our brains.
Okay, but now you said that you read in a journal that we ate more meat in the past, but wasn't our animal products more organic in the past, thus make them more safer than they are right now?
Before World War II, 90% of our cattle were outside on grass, so indeed it would have produced a much healthier quality beef. But if we look back at the quantity of meat that we would have been eating, even in the 1800s, we were known as a land of meat eaters. If you look at old cookbooks and old magazines from the 1800s, you'll see that meat was a large emphasis of our diet. It was after sort of the large bout of immigration that we had in the early 1900s, when suddenly we had millions of new people in the United States in particular. And what happened was there wasn't enough meat to feed all of these new immigrants. So essentially around that era, what happened was we started displacing meat then and replacing it with wheat, essentially. In a nutshell, that's what happened. So really the rise of eating more plant-based foods in our diets happened in and around 100 years ago.
Okay, but my question is it safe to consume all these higher diet and animal products when they're being force-fed steroids, and they're not allowed to eat or to live a organic lifestyle.
Well, Steve, let me tell you a story. I teach classes about the return of eating 3 square meals a day the way we used to eat when we weren't fat phobic and cholesterol phobic and egg phobic and meat phobic, etc. And I get women in my class who are sometimes single women on a very limited budget, and they get scared off of eating meat and eggs and dairy, and so they're worried about the factory farming issue. And what ends up happening is these women end up feeding their children way too many plant-based foods, things like soy and salad. And unfortunately, these children end up with severe learning and cognition problems. And when I tell them the baseline, here's what I want people to do. I want people to eat 3 square meals a day to mimic what we would have eaten, say, prior to World War II. And if you can, Steve, if you have access to buying farm fresh foods where the animals right. are indeed out on pasture and they haven't been given any drugs, that's your gold standard, Steve. And if you can get that, that's fantastic. But I don't want to scare anybody away from eating the baseline, and that is 3 square meals per day.
There are, and there are, for instance, in St. Catharines, and I'm just trying to think, Pilgrim's Progress, is that the name of it? It's right on the corner of Welland Street. But, I mean, there are butchers out there
right.
who will stock, organic meat. And you can go to their grocery store, and it's slightly more expensive. However, when we pay already some of the lowest food prices in the world, Pam will tell you it's, well worth it. Stephen, I got to leave it there. Thanks
Thank
for your
you.
Call.
Welcome.
Pam, let me get back to one of the things, the glycemic index.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how appropriate is that to use when we talk about, you want to use low glycemic index foods when we're talking about carbohydrates so you don't have that insulin spike?
Yes, you have to be very careful with the glycemic index. The birth of it actually comes from the food industry itself. So just to give you an example, they might tell you, white rice has a higher glycemic index than brown rice, therefore eat brown rice. But is still eating lots of brown rice terribly good for you? Well, eating small amounts of it will be fine, but we don't want to focus on, the brown rice, for example, because what ends up happening when people focus on the glycemic index is they eat all these low glycemic foods, and they tend to be mostly plant-based foods in their diet, and they think that they're doing themselves a favor. So
right.
in a sense, the glycemic index is a really clever marketing ploy, because when you compare glycemic index to the glycemic load, what you can end up doing is eating that brown rice along with some carrots and, lots of other fruits and vegetables, for example, and then what you've done is you've spiked your insulin because you've overconsumed still too much sugar in one sitting. So it's a little deceptive, Tom, to rely on the glycemic index. What I tell people is I want them to modify their overall consumption of plant-based foods in their diet so that they don't exceed 72 grams of sugar or carbohydrates in their diet per day. And that ends up looking like what we would have eaten before World War II. That would have been, eating sort of, a piece of meat with maybe even some cooked broccoli or cooked carrots or beans or something like that, and the vegetables would have had lots of butter put on them. So when you add up what 72 grams of carbohydrates looks like, it's actually about 6 servings of fruits or vegetables per day. And it's not huge amounts of fruits and vegetables, but it's enough to give you the antioxidants that you need.
I'm just looking up the Pilgrim's drug-free meats, which I've gone in to get pork before. 24 Welland Avenue, right between Queen and Wellington, right across from the school almost, for those who are in St. Catharines. So I just had to sidetrack you for a second there, because I was thinking Pilgrim something, but it's a local butcher that is, as they say, drug-free meats. So,
good.
I don't know how, if they're all grass-fed or free-range, but I know they're hormone and drug-free.
Good.
Tell me about this University of Minnesota starvation experiment. So, first they fed the guys 3,200 calories a day, and then they went through a 6-month semi-starvation phase. Semi-starvation, I say that because it still was 1,800 calories, which is not what you're required, but it's certainly not 800 calories, which some modern diets, when they're looking to lose weight, ask for, which is like, who could live on 800 calories?
Mm-hmm.
So tell me about the University of Minnesota starvation experiment and what they found out.
Yeah, in and around, this experiment took place in and around the Second World War, and what they did was they took a bunch of very young, healthy men, and they were all conscientious objectors to the war, and they put them on this diet to see what would happen to them, essentially, if they reduced or actually started feeding them the foods that people would have consumed in Europe during war-torn times. So there was a lot of limitations on things like meat and butter. So these men were fed a lot of plant-based foods, and I think the diet only consisted of eating maybe a glass of milk a day or per meal, for example, on top of eating lots of rutabagas and all sorts of other plant-based foods. But yes, the caloric intake would have decreased down to about 1,800 calories per day. And actually, the research project was set up to see what would happen after they went through this starvation phase to see if vitamin supplements would actually help rehabilitate them. So that was the goal of the actual study. But what was interesting during the six-month semi-starvation phase, when these men were on a high carbohydrate, low-fat diet, they developed all sorts of severe psychological symptoms in some cases.
Really?
A couple of them ended up having to be committed in a psychiatric hospital. And the reason why this study is important is because it's not the only study that shows that when you reduce certain nutrients in your diet, the first symptoms are going to be psychological problems.
Maybe that's why the book is titled Skinny Bitch. I was just thinking of that. I know you hate that book, but I'm like, maybe that's why. That's why you get that bitchy attitude when you're on that severe diet, because your brain isn't getting fed anything.
Yeah, they get very deficient in some very key nutrients that stabilize their mood. So, yeah, it's what you end up finding when people reduce animal foods in their diet is they have a lot of issues with mood problems. They get a lot of fatigue, depression, anxiety. They get a lot of, anger issues as well surface, and it's really just a sign of starvation. So I bring this up about the Minnesota starvation experiment because it's really, it's no mystery why we're seeing so many psychological problems in society today. We don't need to be building multi-million dollar hospitals to house these people. What we need to do is actually give them the nutrients that their brain requires, and it's going to save our government is going to save society billions of dollars every year if we just acknowledge the importance of animal fats and animal foods in general in our diet. And I don't see this happening, Tom, anytime soon. I see this happening at a grassroots educational level. But when the food industry has so much control over our governments and our universities and our media, it's very difficult to get people over their fear of eating things like meat and butter.
Another butcher came up, Lakeland Meats. Oh, Lakeland Meats. And Lakeland Meats here in St. Catharines as well has specialized in local and naturally fed farm-raised game meats such as venison, elk, wild boar, bison, kangaroo, camel, ostrich, pheasant, duck, quail, partridge, rabbit, trout, pickerel, and arctic char, and locally, and of course, beef, Berkshire pork, lamb, chicken, and water buffalo, as well as free-run eggs. St. Paul Street West, just a little outside of the city, is Lakeland Game Meats. I'll stop by there today, I think.
And since I'm talking to London today, the Covent Garden Market downtown has a brochure that you can pick up that shows a host of different farms in the area of London where you can get grass-fed meat, pastured chicken, pastured eggs, and so on.
And we've talked about this before, taking that next step and establishing a relationship with your farmer. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing, it's great when you go, I have nothing against the supermarket, and this is where a lot of people shop for convenience. But if you take that next step, especially farmers markets where we go for, especially in and around here, and London as well, locally grown produce. Okay, that's great. But taking that next step and getting to know, not just through your farmers market, but actually your farmer for your eggs, for your dairy, perhaps, but most importantly, for your meat. Get to know your farmer. So how's the meat raised and how's it fed, especially?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I know I've mentioned this to you on the show before, but I can't emphasize enough that 100 years ago, one of the world-renowned experts on school feeding was Louise Stevens Bryant, and I have a copy of her book about school feeding. And she noted even 100 years ago that children with mood, learning, behavior problems weren't eating enough animal foods at home. And so what the school feeding program was supposed to do was to feed the children the nutrients, the nutrient-dense foods that they weren't getting at home. And so the emphasis of the diets 100 years ago in schools would have been to make sure the children were getting full-fat dairy products, butter, that they were getting meat in the diet and so on. And they knew that when they started feeding the children these nutrient-dense foods, that this would help improve their mood, learning, and behavior. And unfortunately, what we see now with a lot of these healthy school initiatives is the avoidance of the very foods that these children need for proper growth and development.
All right, when we come back, we'll talk a bit. I got another question for you, but from a listener, but we'll talk about the at least moving somewhat in the right direction, I would think, is that the breakfast programs, a study done in Toronto, shows that breakfast programs actually improve learning. All right, so we'll talk about breakfast programs actually improve learning, but I'll get your ideas about what you'd like to see in a breakfast program when we come back. It's 10:47. My name's Tom McConnell, nutritional consultant. Pam Colleen joining us. London, you're well familiar with Pam Colleen, and our Niagara listeners know her well by now. But we'll be back right after this quick break on 1290 CJBK and News Talk 610 CKTV. 10:52 is our time, so let's get John in from London. How are you, sir?
I'm very good, thanks.
You got a question for Pam?
Yes, I just wondered, Pam, you know, it's very difficult to eat the way you're suggesting to eat when all the doctors and everything are completely opposite. A friend of mine had some prostate cancer, and the first thing he said to cut out the red meat and do all these things. And has there ever been a study done that's actually measured a person's cholesterol levels, their blood pressure, by eating, you know, a fair amount of meat and butter and this type of thing?
Has Yeah. There's been a couple. Well, I can tell you of a couple of studies that I've seen, but Pam, you can probably have more insight.
You know, because of the demonization of these foods, it's rare to see studies done to show the favorable effects of eating these foods. There are some studies that have been done, and now they're sort of slowly trickling out. But I want you to return to common sense here. How could an old-fashioned food be causing a modern disease? That's what we need to be asking. And that's what the doctors, that's what scientific community, that's what our governments are not asking. They're putting us on a fad diet where it has absolutely no historical precedence. We've never followed a diet low in animal fat ever in the history of mankind. We just started following this diet over the last few decades, and look at how sick we are because of it. Our bodies are simply not adapting to the displacement of these nutrient-dense animal foods and replacement of these foods with more plant-based foods. And so, really, we have to return to common sense.
Now, what about Pam, what about these cultures that seem to be, the longevity seems to be there, like a seven-day Adventist and so on, who don't consume that type of diet? Like, how do you explain their longevity and so on?
Yeah, and I teach this in my classes that, you know, we look at a lot of this information, and unfortunately we hold it as being truthful. There's a lot of very dangerous misinformation out there about the emphasis of plant-based foods on the diet. If you actually spend some time looking and digging deeply into the literature, you'll find out that, you know, that these cultures that do emphasize plant-based foods in their diets are actually much thicker than people who eat traditional foods. You know, the rise of vegetarianism came about because of a problem with overpopulation. It didn't come about because of anything to do with health. And then the vegan diet, the diet that actually endorses no animal foods, actually was invented in order to curb lust, in order to kill people's sex drive. So, you know, this is all a matter of historical record, but unfortunately what has happened over the last couple hundred years is that these plant-based diets have been, you know, heavily propagandized to be very healthy, and they're not. You know, the expression, a little bit of knowledge can be a very dangerous thing. And a lot of the nutritional information we're getting today is based on marketing-based science, dogma, and urban myth. So you have to be very discerning today when you hear this information and dig very deeply. And I used to believe that what you told me there, I used to believe that the Seventh-day Adventists were extremely healthy until I started meeting them in person. And then I started questioning, because I was a vegetarian. I ate, you know, I was a strict vegan, and I believed wholeheartedly that it was a healthy diet. And I had to learn the hard way that it certainly wasn't, and that the information I was being told was untrue.
Now, if you wanted to, the person wanted to gain weight, like, you know, weightlifting, and try to build up the body, would it be advisable to eat your type of diet to do that? Can you actually gain weight if you wish?
Well, it's going to depend on what's happening with that individual. But as a general rule of thumb, when we look at when we ate 3 square meals a day back before World War II, and even later than that, when we ate 3 square meals a day, we were actually pretty normal weight. We didn't have a lot of problems with overweight or obesity back then.
Those are nutrient-dense foods.
Yeah, we emphasized our calories on eating the butter and the lard and the meat and the bacon and the eggs, and we didn't have any of those food phobias back then.
Right.
And we were much healthier then than we are now.
And coconut oil, it's good too?
Yes, yes. If you enjoy coconut oil,
on a salad or something like that.
Some people enjoy the coconut oil. My preference is for butter because it's a more local food.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly a lot of people do enjoy the benefits of eating coconut oil, and a lot of people enjoy the taste, but that's all relative.
John, I just got to leave it there. Thanks for the call, because May in St. Catharines, you have a question for Pam. Hello, May.
Hello.
You have a question for Pam.
Yes. Oh, hi. Hi.
Hi, May. Hi. How are you today?
Oh, I'm fine. I was listening to you talking about the food scheme. If our children suffer from diabetes, and I kind of cringe when I see the hot dogs and the macaroni, wouldn't it be better to cut on our house and give those children the good cup of soup and hot chocolate and hot milk once a week, like they used to give them, and of the four groups at least every day a double sandwich or so in the areas where they've even cut out economics too? And
well, I think what we need to do for children is feed them the most nutrient-dense foods possible, and that includes full-fat dairy products. And unfortunately, here in this province, our children are getting reduced-fat dairy products and even being told to avoid things like butter. And this is the absolute opposite advice. This is just dangerous information and wrong advice for our children in terms of their growth and their development.
Pam, can I ask you to stick around for 5 more minutes?
Yeah, I sure can.
All right, I got a couple questions on the line. Hang on, Jeff in London, we'll get to you right after the news, but I got to get to the news, and then we'll come back a little bit more with Pam Colleen here on 1290 CJBK and News Talk 610 CKTB.
Here's Tom McConnell.
And cue Tom.
And the big voice guy complains because we pay him by the word. So it's about, he gets cut off. It's a, hey, you're taking food off my table. So I got to make sure the big voice guy gets. All right, good morning. Once again, 7 minutes after 11 o'clock. I'll put up these a little later on. Pam Colleen, nutritional consultant. How are you once again? Thanks for sticking around.
No problem.
I was just trying to remember the great video. I think you sent it to me, but Robert Lustig from the University of California, San Francisco, talking about sugar and especially fructose. And he's an endocrinologist, and he goes through the science on sugar and what it does to your body. But if you have, I know it's lengthy. I think it's about 90 minutes, but I'll put it on my page. And the one that really started me off was Dr. David Diamond, mm-hmm. who is down in Florida. He's a neuroscientist, and he wanted to lose weight. And so his doctor recommended putting him on a statin to lower his cholesterol. And he did all the research, and he was like, that's exactly what we should not be doing. And then he talks about how he increased his consumption of animal fats, and it decreased his cholesterol, and how he became healthier and lost a lot of weight through more of an animal fat-based diet. But I'll put that video up there as well. And he's just over an hour. But mm-hmm. both of the guys, if you have time, both of the guys, Lustig's presentation is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And Diamond's is really good as well. Both of them independently do all the research and show you all the science and talk you through it. And it's not that complex in terms of, I have a bit of a science background so I can follow along, but I don't think anyone's going to be lost out there. And the great thing is you can always rewind it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, both of them, I'll put them up.
It's friendly. Yeah, it's not overbearing or complicated information. Robert Lustig's video is called Sugar, the Bitter Truth.
That's it.
And I would encourage everybody as well to take a look at the current issue of Newsweek magazine with Gary Taub's article in it as well. But there is another study that has been done out in British Columbia by Dr. Jay Wertman. And the results of that study have been produced into a documentary called My Big Fat Diet, Tom. And that's another really interesting you know, perspective and in terms of research, what kind of results we can expect to see if people return to eating animal fats in their diet. So what Dr. Wortman did is he took about 100 subjects out in this small community in British Columbia, and he put them on a traditional foods diet, which, of course, included lots of animal fat. And within a year, I think these 100 people were able to lose about a half a ton of weight, and many of them were able to either come off of their medications or reduce their medications dramatically.
So my big fat diet is, I'm just looking it up right now, it's a series.
It was a one-part, one-hour documentary.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah, no. Part two, the parts are only like 6-7 minutes long. So I'll try to find where it's on YouTube. It's part one of three, but part, you know, it's 15 minutes each part. So I'll try to find it in one continuous video.
Yeah, and it's a CBC documentary. And I have interviewed Dr. Wortman a couple of times, and he works for Health Canada, and he actually went to Health Canada with these results, and they basically, you know, kind of turned a blind eye to it. And they said, well, it's just too controversial, because they will not let go of this notion that animal fats are allegedly bad for us. They really hold on to this, and the reason why is because they have so much pressure from the edible oil industry to keep promoting edible oils and demonizing things like butter and lard.
Jeff in London, good morning.
Good morning, Tom. How are you doing?
I am great. Thank you so much for holding.
No problem. Hi, Pam. How are you doing?
I'm great, Jeff.
Good. So, you know, there's lots of studies out there, and I guess really I'm just calling in support of Pam, and I'll use my own example in my own life. My mother-in-law lives with us. She's 93 years of age. She lives, her suite is on the second floor. She does a flight of stairs probably 15 times a day. And, you know, she's a perfect example to us internally, and, you know, in our family. And she just says, you know what, you just eat like, you keep your diet simple. And it's the diet she had when she was, you know, 10 years of age, and it's the diet she still has. She is, she doesn't go to fitness anymore because she tore a rotator cuff, and she's going to be getting that looked at. But other than that, she's remained active. She eats red meat, white meat, pink meat. She loves meat. She loves butter. She'll say, I don't really like milk because we used to get it from the cow and it was warm, but she still drinks it because she knows the benefits of it. And it's a very, very simple, basic, easy to understand, easy to comprehend way of eating. And she has one medication that she takes.
Mm-hmm.
She's 93 years of age. She's on one medication. She does, you know, she's active all day. She still paints. She still goes out. As I said, she doesn't go to the gym anymore, but she used to go up until 92, three times a week. And, you know, there's no vegan diet. There's no diet of any kind. She just uses natural foods. And if she wants something, you know, that's sweet, she bakes cookies from natural recipes and flours and things that we've been using for hundreds of years, and it's a perfect example to everyone in our family who's tried all kinds of different diets and have never been as successful as staying, you know, as fit and healthy as her.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Jeff, and I do get to hear wonderful stories like that over and over again, just validating the fact that we need to return to common sense eating. The problem we have is the misinformation, and that's what's very dangerous, and that's why I teach classes that are 16 hours long. It's not because the information is complicated, it's because I'm trying to help everybody overcome all the misinformation that we're getting. And, you know, even something, the misinformation around butter and margarine, like your mother knew to continue to eat butter even while they were demonizing this wonderful sacred food. And today, of course, what do you see? Most people are still eating margarine. And really, if you look at the research, you'll see that margarine contributes to a lot of health problems. It's never been the butter. It's the margarine.
Right. Yeah, I agree. It's, as I said, it's funny to watch her, you know, and everything is just in proportion. It's there's meat on there, there's potatoes. I mean, sort of that old school mentality that we once had in terms of eating. She said to me once, she read an article by someone out of California, and they talked about an anthropological diet. And she asked me what that was, and, you know, we read the article further. And it was pretty simple. It was, a practice that she follows, which is basically, you know, what did we eat 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago. And, you know, there were the list of things that we had. And she sat down and looked at her own diet and said, well, that's pretty much what I eat. And so, you know, if you follow that, it'll give you at least a pretty good baseline of what your body needs.
That's right. In order to decide what is healthy, we do need to look at history. We can't look at something that is new to man. And so this is one of the main messages I have to my students, and that is, if you want to find out if the nutritional information you're hearing is correct and is truly healthy, you must ask yourself these questions. Number one, does this information prove to me that couples are fertile? Does this information prove to me that babies are healthy? Does it prove to me that there's no chronic disease or mental disorders in society? Are the aging gracefully? And are senior citizens still productive members of society? So if you're listening to newfangled fad diets, you know, unfortunately, they have no historical precedence whatsoever. There's no evidence to say that they're healthy. They're just based on marketing-based science, dogma, or urban myth.
Jeffrey, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Ryan in St. Catharines, let me squeeze you in before the break.
Hello.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
How are you doing, Tom? How are you doing, Pam?
Great, Ryan. How are
Excellent.
You?
Excellent.
Not too bad. I have a question about my son. He's 10 years old. He's been a vegetarian for 2 years, over 2 years, I believe. He lives with his mother, so I don't have too much control over what he eats. I don't force him to eat meat because it's his choice. He has his own personality. I let him do it. But I find recently he's gaining weight. He's not losing weight by any means. And he's been sick now with a throat problem for over 2 months. He hasn't been able to talk. Mm-hmm. He whispers.
Yeah.
And he drinks a lot of soy.
Mm.
All vegetarian. He won't touch meat. Nothing. He wouldn't even eat gummy bears at one point because of the animal byproduct in the jelly. Mm-hmm. He eats that now, but he hasn't touched meat, fish, anything for 2 years. I think it bothers me because he's young, and I think maybe he needs more of that stuff. But his mother is dead set against it because
he most certainly would need, for proper growth and development, more animal fats in the diet. And you have every right to be concerned. You know, the children in particular do need lots of what are known as the fat-soluble vitamins in their diet, vitamin A and vitamin D. And these are nutrients that you would only find in things like, butter and meat and eggs and so on. So, unfortunately, when children are reducing or removing these foods from their diet, they're going to be deficient in these very, very key nutrients. And on top of that, they're going to be demineralized as well. They're not going to get enough of the minerals in their diet. So there's going to be a lot of potential problems happening because of that. And also, just another very important point, I do see this a lot with vegetarians because they are eating so many plant-based foods in their diet. You have to remember that it's carbohydrates that drive insulin, and insulin that drives fat. So I do see a lot of overweight vegetarians who don't understand this this principle.
Well, he's a vegetarian that doesn't like vegetables. That's what I find very funny. He's a very picky child eater. It bothers me that he eats lettuce a lot and stuff like that. And I actually give them eggs with butter every weekend when they sleep over at my house, which I like because at least there's some protein in the eggs and like the butter. I don't use margarine. I use butter.
Good.
But she disagrees with that because she thinks there's too many hormones in buttermilk and all the dairy. So she buys soy products for almost everything.
Well, one of the books she should read is called The Whole Soy Story, and it's about the dark side of soy, and it's by Dr. Kayla Daniel. And I have a books page on my website, which is pamkaleen.com, and that books page is there as a reference for people who are looking to find out why these animal foods are so important for us. And I will tell you that there's just every single month, it seems, as there's a new book coming out validating the importance of animal fat. So I do see that we're moving in the right direction. We're still very much a minority out there, but we are moving in the right direction. And there's a new book out called The Happiness Diet. And the authors of this book have delved deeply into the research to show how important animal fats are, in particular, for mood. So that's a new book that just came out as well. But if you go to my books page, there's lots and lots of books that you can take a look at and help educate your child and so on.
Ryan, thanks for the call, buddy. Good luck.
Thank you, guys. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Quick break in the program. One more segment coming up next with Pam Killeen. This is News Talk 1290 CJBK and 610 CKTV. 24 minutes after 11 o'clock, so we got about 5 minutes here. Let's squeeze in a couple more questions. Terry, good morning.
How's it going?
Good. You got a question for Pam Killeen?
Yes, I do. Hey, Pam. Myself,
Every day I'm up around 5. I have about 5 or 6 coffees a day, and when I'm taking those coffees, I'm putting at least three sugars each in each one.
Wow.
Is that bad for me?
Well, what you're trying to do is essentially turn on your adrenal glands so that you get some energy. It's not going to be real energy. It's going to be a wired and tired kind of feeling that you get. And so, you know, you have to be very, very careful on any kind of stimulant that you're taking in. And you're taking in 2 stimulants, both caffeine and sugar. It would be one thing, I think, if somebody had a little bit of coffee and a little bit of sugar and they were healthy to begin with. But if people have to depend on that much of a stimulant, then I'd say, you know, there's some issue going on with your adrenal glands. And that opens up a whole can of worms here. But essentially, you know, if you can cut back on your coffee and sugar, that would help, but there's still something going on. That is, why are you so tired in the first place that you have to rely on coffee for energy?
He gets up so early.
No. Like, I'm not tired. It's just like I'm up every day at 5 o'clock. And
what time do you go to bed at, Terry?
Early, around I'd say 9 o'clock.
Well, that's not bad.
Good.
All right, there's 8 hours.
Yeah, over time, what that does is it stresses the adrenal glands, and you know, I don't know how many years you've been consuming that much caffeine and sugar, but it's what it does in the long run. You know, after chronic use, it ends up wearing down the adrenal glands, and then you have to depend on it for energy. So there's no real energy keeping you going during the day.
So can you cut back? Can you go to decaf once one or two of the cups?
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, that's why. No, but slowly we have to go. Slowly you have to. You can't go cold turkey, but slowly you got to wean it back. And then have you tried creaming your coffee instead of sugar? Only because the lactose in the cream is probably a little healthier for you than the fructose in the sugar.
Well, one thing, the reason why I said that, because like my dad, he lived till he was 93. And he was always had a sweet tooth, and like I kind of inherited that from my dad. Mm-hmm. And like I'm going on 50 now, and I've never had I've always been a go guy. Eh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you have to ask yourself, you know, on a scale, like how many cylinders are you really running on in a given day? Like a lot of people I work with are lucky if they're running on 1 or 2 cylinders out of 8 cylinders. And I think everybody deserves to run on all 8 cylinders. And unfortunately, when people aren't running on all 8 cylinders, they need things like caffeine and sugar to get through the day. And to me, that's telling me that there's something wrong with somebody's biochemistry if that's the only thing that's going to get them through the day.
Terry, I got to leave it there. Thanks for the call, buddy.
Okay, thank you.
Doesn't want to try decaf. Marcus in London, how are you?
Thank you very much. And Pam Colleen, I want to say thank you so very much for your time and effort in educating us on the radio here. I greatly appreciate it. It has changed our perception and so forth. Even today, I've been boiling a chicken for the last 2 hours, getting a stock. I'm going to add some carrots and rice for the soup for my kids. And also, I just needed to ask the question in regards to, is the obesity problem related to the corn syrup in the food, in all the products? Like, you know, is that the major problem where we tell my children fast food restaurants is just candy food? Am I correct in saying that the corn syrup is the problem with the obesity as well?
That's a big contributing factor, Marcus, and thank you so much for your encouraging words. And Tom, like you said, you're going to be putting Robert Lustig's video, The Sugar, the Bitter Truth.
Yeah.
Okay. And Dr. Lustig has done so much research on exactly what you're talking about, Marcus.
Okay.
And it is indeed a lot of the obesity and diabetes, or diabesity as we're seeing today, can be blamed on the high fructose corn syrup. There's no question about it.
Great. I tell my kids, pop drinks are just for birthdays and Christmas.
You know what? And the one thing that I've cut back on, Pam, and we've had success in this radio station, 2 fellow employees. One lost, I think, about 20 pounds. The other guy lost 30 pounds. No change to their diet, except they cut out the pop.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. They just cut out the pop because the sugar gets stored as fat. Mm-hmm. That's what people can't get beyond. They just can't get beyond.
Carbohydrates? Exactly. Yeah. Carbohydrates drive insulin. Insulin drives fat. And what we've been doing over the last 50 years is increasing our consumption of carbohydrates in general.
Pam, always a pleasure. Thanks for the extra long one today. We'll have to make sure we do more callers next couple times for sure.
That'd be great, Tom. Thank you so much.
Take care. Pam Colleen, nutritional consultant, joining us on the program. When we come back, let me get this story in. Walking and texting. New Jersey town is ticketing people for walking and texting. 117 tickets they've given out for the super distraction, as they call it. News is next on 610 CKTV and News Talk 610 CK 1290 CJBK.